from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. All pretense falls away in a crisis. It's true for individuals, and it's true for nations. That which we believed about ourselves, our society at large, gets tested. Is the United States really the most capable, most powerful nation on Earth? Well, a microscopic microbe is testing that fundamental notion of American exceptionalism. A pandemic we saw coming is showing us that the nation still wasn't prepared. Well, why is that? What is it about the United States, not just over the past couple of years, but even the past couple of generations, that's making the nation particularly vulnerable now? And can we change it? This hour on Point, what the coronavirus tells America about itself. And we're going to start today with Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. He joins us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So what do you think the coronavirus is sort of revealing about America now?
Well, the president the other day said that we're in a war against an invisible enemy. He meant the virus. But I think it's also true culturally that we're in war against ourselves, or to put it another way, against American individualism, the sort of magnetic north of our cultural setting. A crisis like this strains the solidarity that individualism is already straining, and it makes it very difficult to get to the point where Tocqueville talked about the curb on American individualism, which he thought was self-interest rightly understood. He says, each American knows when to sacrifice some of his private interests to save the rest. Well, it's hard to know whether that's still true or not, and whether that will remain true as this crisis develops. You can see all sorts of breakdown in social behavior, the kids down on the beach, the people restive in their home coops. Frank Bruni puts it well when he says the paradox: to pull together, we must stay apart. Mm-hmm. But in staying apart, are we able to pull together? And will the impulses of American individualism, really quite fulsomely expressed in the president, his expressive individualism, his sense that self-interest is everything to him, Will that kind of individualism that he models all the time spread through the society and as it were, recall our basic curb on solidarity? Mm-hmm. And will this limit the power of what public health needs to do? Will we cease cooperating? I think that's the big question. And individualism, in that sense, is an enemy of the public health.
It's so fascinating, Jack. It sounds like you're asking, can we pull together and act for the greater good, while at the same time, for so long, Americans have believed that the greater good lies in themselves, in their individual good, right? I mean, it's that tension that you're talking about.
That's right. That's right. And it's that, and we have it in the economics, the market, metaphors of laissez-faire and keep the state out of it and self-interest there, and we have it in the emotional life. I am this special person. The world exists as a theater to allow me to express myself and define myself. And all the stress today on identity, on separateness, on what all of this is against the grain of this current crisis. Where we need to think in terms of the whole. And right. Tocqueville thought that was our genius. We'll have to see whether he was right and whether we can set apart our selfish desires for the good of the whole.
Exactly. Well, and it's a challenging one because, of course, I'm also thinking of all the amazing aspects of this nation that do flower from a sense of freedom and individuality and the ability to be oneself as well. So, I mean, it's a challenging moment, and that's why we want to wrap our heads around it. And this conversation, by the way, I should say, is inspired by a really fascinating article that recently appeared in The Atlantic. It's headlined, "The Coronavirus Called America's Bluff," and it was written by Anne Applebaum. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and she joins us now from Poland via Skype. Anne Applebaum, welcome to On Point.
Delighted to be here virtually.
As we all are these days.
Yes,
well,
indeed.
Anne, I was wondering if you might start us where you started your analysis of this moment in America. And you actually go way back to 1853. Why is that?
I was looking for a metaphor. I wanted to get across to Americans the size and the scale of what has just happened and what is about to happen, and how much they should take it to heart, and how much it should show them that their image of themselves is not what it should be. And I chose as a kind of metaphor a famous historical moment, which is when Commodore Matthew Perry of the U.S. Navy sailed into Tokyo Bay with a couple of steamships and some modern guns. And he delivered a letter to the Japanese from President Fillmore demanding that they open up their ports to American trade. And then as they left, Perry's boats fired up into the air. And the Japanese were terrified. And there's a famous diarist who wrote at the time, you know, "This sounded like distant thunder. The mountains echoed back of the shots." And what that visit did for the Japanese was it showed them that their perception of themselves, which is they were at the center of the world, you know, the vertex of the earth, as a famous nationalist writer said, was wrong, and that they needed to massively change their bureaucracy, their society, their education system, their attitude to science. They needed to rethink their government in order to compete with the modern world. And this incident led to something called the Meiji Restoration, and it was the modernization of Japan and the creation of essentially a new kind of nation. This is not an exact analogy by any means to what's going on now, and there are all kinds of reasons why it's, you know, not we're not talking about the same thing. But what I wanted to show Americans was the scale of what we are being shown. And I don't think it's just about American individualism. I think it's very specific. One of the incidents that I describe in the article is something that when I read it in the New York Times shocked me, which is the story of a flu specialist in Seattle called Helen Chu, who had taken swabs from people back in January as part of a flu study. And when she heard about the coronavirus coming from China, she decided to check them to see if any of these people had the coronavirus. And she asked for permission to do so, and she was told, "No, you don't have the right to do it. There are technical reasons. Your lab can't do it," and so on. Then she decided to do it, and she found evidence of a teenager who'd never been abroad who had the virus. That meant that it was spreading in the community. That meant that it was time to act. It was very urgent. And this is the end of February. And again, she was told not to test. And my reflection was, we don't live in a communist society like China. There were no goons who came to her door and told her to be quiet, like happened in Wuhan, you know, that Chinese doctors were silenced by the state. But she was effectively silenced by our ineffective bureaucracy, by a scientific establishment that's not up to the game, by officials high up in the CDC and HHS who were partly at the bidding of the president. We can talk about that if you want. Reluctant to focus on this story.
So there's a lot to dig into in there. And first of all, let's. I just want to ask you about you say a scientific establishment in the United States that wasn't up to the game. I'd say I'm not quite sure about that, because in the past several weeks we've been talking to a whole stream of physicians and scientists who say,
fantastic.
Yeah, pandemics past or epidemics past, H1N1 keeps coming up, that the response was actually far better in the United States, but something fundamentally different happened this time around. So I'm just wondering, is it that the nation has changed in the past couple of years, or is there something even deeper that we need to look further back at?
I mean, I think there are a couple of things to say. I mean, one of them is that and this is, you know, strangely, I used to do reporting on this subject 10 or 15 years ago. you know, when it, right after 9/11, I wrote a lot about this issue because it was in the news at the time. And I had a lot of context at the CDC and among people who worked on pandemics and bioterrorism and so on. And I went back and talked to them last week, and they all said, yeah, you know, the CDC was a great institution. There's still fantastic scientists there. They're wonderful people. You know, our nation has, as you say, we have some of the best scientists in the world. We have the best labs in the world. You know, we are at the cutting edge of all kinds of technologies. But the government bureaucracy that runs science, in other words, the CDC itself, had been partially hollowed out. It had been politicized. It had been not taken seriously. You know, and that's a longer term issue. You know, that goes back beyond this administration. But in addition to that, this specific administration had, you know, from January, the president of the United States had made it clear to people, and in some public statements, and clearly in some private ones as well, that he didn't want too much talk of this disease coming to the fore. And officials around him would have known that. I mean, as we all know, there's famously, he said, when he didn't want a cruise ship full of infected Americans to dock in California, he said, I like the numbers being where they are. I don't need to have the numbers double because of one ship that wasn't our fault. In other words, that was him saying, I don't want to know about infected Americans. I only care about the numbers. And the top officials around him knew that that was his attitude. And they knew that, you know, that talking too much about this, bothering the president with it, was going to upset him. And this is because, you know, Trump created around himself a kind of authoritarian culture of the kind that we haven't had in American politics recently, or not in living memory, which is not that different from authoritarian cultures in other places where people are afraid to tell the truth and they're afraid to talk to the president because he might be distressed. So we had, I think, two things going on. One was a lack of investment, not in science itself, but in the bureaucracies of science and in the expertise, government experts, in the kinds of people who need to take decisions about public health. This is not a question of pure science.
Right.
It's a question of government science.
Yeah. And if you can just stand by here for just a second, and Jack Beattie, hang on there as well. We are talking about how coronavirus may be calling America's bluff about what we believe about this nation. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Anne Applebaum. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and a staff writer for The Atlantic. She's written a fascinating and provocative piece in The Atlantic headlined, "The Coronavirus Called America's Bluff." We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Anne is also a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We're joined also today by Jack Beattie. He is On Point's news analyst, and he's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And folks, we want to hear from you. What do you think the coronavirus is revealing about America right now, about what we think we're capable of doing? Now, Anne, you know, one of the most fascinating things about what we're globally experiencing right now is this is happening almost everywhere at once, right? Right. So many nations are being tested. And you write about, in your piece, you write about how you can see what the different reactions in different nations really say, right? I mean, we talked about China very briefly and its authoritarian initial response. You note how Singapore immediately creates an app so they can track all people who have the infection. You interestingly note that in Germany, Chancellor Merkel spoke honestly about the percentage of Germans who might end up with coronavirus, and somehow that didn't tank the German markets. And of course, Italy is an outstanding example too, which we'll talk about in a minute. So what does that tell you in comparison to how the United States is responding now? Anne, are you there? We're going to try and get Anne Applebaum back on the line. She was joining us via Skype from Poland, so we'll try to get her back. But Jack Beatty, let me just turn, if I could turn that same question to you about, you know, how Anne in her piece notes that we saw different types of responses from different countries. What do you make of that?
Well, countries will respond according to, I think, their cultural DNA, their the habits of the heart, as Tocqueville put it, that make them the people they are. And I've been impressed, for one at least, by the behavior of Italian citizens. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the government has been late and so on, but there's been an extraordinary, at least from the news reporting, you see, an extraordinary kind of acceptance of the really draconian limits on public association. You see people entertaining themselves. You see people playing instruments on balconies, and a kind of I won't say fatalism, but acceptance of this necessity to isolate themselves to save the whole. And I'm impressed by the sort of spirit you see there. Among people, and it seems wonderfully Italian in its acceptance and in its view of we can entertain each other, we can make the best of this.
Indeed. Well, do Anne Applebaum, do we have you back?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, great. Sorry, my apologies for the technical difficulties there. But so the question I was going to ask you, hopefully you heard it, was about this, the comparison of how this is happening everywhere at once around the world, and we're seeing things about different nations in terms of how they react. And I was wondering why you pointed that out, particularly in your piece.
So I think when we're talking about countries like South Korea or Singapore or Germany, we're talking about countries where people have a lot of faith in the state. And they believe their leaders. And that doesn't mean they're not critical of them. I mean, certainly South Korea and Germany are both very vigorous democracies. But they have some fundamental faith that their leaders are people who are interested in the well-being of the state. They have faith in the bureaucracies and the experts who work for the state. And so when representatives of the state speak, they believe them and they listen to them and they go along with it. We don't have that anymore in America. And it's partly the fault of Trump, who has exacerbated an existing bad situation. But I think the problem goes back a little bit farther. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reasons for it are probably beyond the scope of this program. But I think this event has shown that Americans don't believe their leaders. You're referring to why aren't people following the rules? Why are they going on spring break to Florida and so on? This is part of the answer as well. It's not just selfishness. It's also that, you know, people just don't believe Trump. They don't believe, you know, what the administration says. They don't believe health officials because they're used to thinking of it, you know, politics is a kind of game. It's all rubbish. You know, it doesn't matter. And, you know, Germans don't think like that. And this is a wake-up call. You know, we need to restore some faith in our institutions. We need to make sure that the best people in our society are going to work for the government, that the government, you know, those kinds of jobs, you know, at the CDC or HHS are not taken by, people who were formerly lobbyists for the healthcare industry. They need to be they need to go to scientists and people with records. We need to think a lot harder about who's running our state and who's running our system, right, and who can have expert voices that people will listen to.
So, Anne, let me just hit this head on. I mean, because you're right, we probably don't have time in the context of an hour-long program, but I do want to just try a little bit here. I mean, isn't part of the problem that at least for 40 years we have been hearing that government is part of the problem in the United States? That has been a long-running message in American politics. And so if that's repeatedly told and then political decisions are made around that ethos, we're going to end up exactly where what you're talking about with lack of faith in institutions, a lack of the highest level expertise in those institutions.
I agree with you completely, you know, and I'm somebody who's written, you know, you mentioned that I'm a historian. I've written, my books are mostly about history of communism. So, you know, I've also thought a lot about what happens in countries where the state runs amok and tries to control too many things and so on. But yes, it does seem to me now that certainly in these areas, you know, in the areas of public health, the environment, regulation. We have gone much too far in the opposite direction. We've acted like everything to do with the government is bad. You know, anybody who works for the government is a bureaucrat, and that's a negative word. You know, how about people who work for the government are civil servants, you know, doing something good on behalf of other people? Why aren't they accorded the kind of respect they should have? Why is the government something that's always negative? You know, why don't we see government officials as being public spirited people who are working on our behalf? I speak as somebody who knows very, very well how government overreach and totalitarianism and the expansion of the state can be also bad. But I absolutely agree that the U.S. has gone too far in the wrong direction. We allowed both private companies and NGOs to take over functions that should belong to the government. And the whole conversation about what the government should do and what the private sector do needs to start again from scratch, and we need to rethink it.
And point well taken about the opposite end of the extreme regarding, you know, communism, authoritarian governments, places that are completely anti-democratic. I mean, we're seeing that, like, China's the perfect counterpoint, actually, at this moment in time as well, for that point. But there's something that you write which I've just found so compelling, and that is the question of modernity now, right? And that's why that example of Japan in 1853 is, I think, actually a really good one, that Japan was confronted with what modernity means at that moment and realized that they were not it. I mean, is that what you're saying at the United States?
Exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, go ahead.
We are not it. We are not it. We don't know how to use technology to monitor illness. We're not using the capabilities of AI to figure out where the next hotspots are going to be of this disease, which I've been talking to people in the last couple of days is apparently possible. We are not using, you know, most of these technologies that we invented, you know, we are not using in intelligent ways. You know, we were way behind South Korea in ramping up production of tests. You know, we're behind other countries, you know, we are less modern. and this is not about democracy and dictatorship. I mean, South Korea is a democracy and Germany is a democracy. You don't need you don't need authoritarianism in order to have intelligent ways to track and follow epidemics. And we don't have them. Those tools are not in place. It's time that we figured out how to use them.
Right. I mean, the question is how bureaucracies, how governments use the tools of modernity, right? That's really the heart of this, because the tools exist. But what you're saying is that right now, for a whole variety of reasons, we don't have the institutions at place that are able to nimbly use those tools for the benefit of all Americans.
Right. We had a researcher in Seattle who knew that the coronavirus was spreading in Seattle, you know, in January. And we didn't let her fight. We didn't let her do any research. We didn't have it's not just about technology. It's also about bureaucracy.
Yes.
It's about systems of communication, about awareness. You know, we didn't have the people in place who could understand what she was saying and could have started tracking people immediately. If we'd started it, in January instead of March, we'd be in a completely different place today.
Wow. Well, Jack Beattie, let me just turn back to you here quickly, because I'm always eager to hear your reflections on things like what Anne's saying. What do you think?
Well, you know, to take the example of that Seattle researcher, she had got the message, but put it this way, the bureaucracy had got the message. The president didn't want numbers. He didn't want this on his record. He personalized it. In his narcissism and political calculation, he had to keep the numbers down, and that seemed to have, he didn't want to know, and it sounds like that message got right into the bureaucracy, and how well represented by his, you know, Alec Azar, who's a, you know, lobbyist, is excuse me, and a toady, and who clearly has been by degrees bringing the president around to reality, and perhaps he's got there, but it's been a long, long pull. Mm.
Well, you know, I want to play a moment from something that Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, something that he recently said, and you pointed out in your piece. This was Thursday of last week when Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz questioned Dr. Fauci about the U.S.'s ability to implement wide-scale testing for coronavirus.
The system is not really geared to what we need right now, what you are asking for. That is a failing. It is a failing. I mean, let's admit it. The fact is, the way the system was set up is that the public health component that Dr. Redfield was talking about was a system where you put it out there in the public and a physician asks for it and you get it. The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
It's Dr. Anthony Fauci, Thursday of last week. Anne Applebaum, why did you think this was a particular moment worthy of noting?
Because Dr. Fauci is exactly the kind of person who should, you know, who is inspiring trust and who should have had an involvement in this from the very beginning or should have been listened to much earlier on. And he was admitting something that you and I have just been discussing, which is that the United States is behind other countries. You know, we failed to ramp up testing when we could have done. I mean, remember that South Korea found out about this just at the same time as we did, and they're testing 10,000 people a day. And we, as of Friday of last week, had only tested 10,000 in total. And so he is somebody, and incidentally, he's a very interesting person in this case because he's also the person who originally had to make the case to the Reagan administration and then later administrations to take the AIDS crisis seriously. This is how he made his name. Mm-hmm. So he's somebody who knows the importance of, you know, bringing, you know, science into the public, persuading officials to take it seriously and treat it seriously. You know, he's somebody with a long background in exactly this world, this kind of, you know, the world of public health and kind of, you know, politics and epidemics.
Well, let's turn to our callers here briefly. Let's go to Ben, who's calling from New Orleans. Ben, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a Katrina survivor, and I always felt like, you know, the rugged individualist logic would have had everybody responsible for their own personal levy, and that the failure of the levy system, underfunded and not taken seriously, just shot holes in that whole way of looking at the world. And then it was frustrating not to see progressives really make that point publicly. And, you know, I wish we had a culture where we understood that everybody's welfare really is bound together.
Right. Ben, thank you so much for that call and for that observation, because I think it's vitally important. I mean, we've had catastrophes in the United States, and is part of the problem that we're not learning enough from them? I mean, why repeat the lessons of Katrina?
You're right. We don't have a culture of learning. We don't, we also have discontinuities in our system of government. You know, of course it's right that every president should bring in new cabinet ministers and new cabinet secretaries and should have his own people around him and so on. But, you know, under our current system, the president appoints thousands and thousands of new people every 4 years. And so we've politicized all kinds of jobs that really have no reason to be political at all. We don't have a civil service ethos in Washington. You know, it's not just the cabinet secretaries, it's their deputies and their deputies' deputies, and sometimes their deputies' deputies' deputies. And we behave like every 4 years or every 8 years, we can just restart the clock and invent everything from scratch. I mean, is that an intelligent way to run a modern country? And remember, you know, this is a health crisis, but there are other kinds of crises down the road that are also going to be very, very high tech and will demand very sophisticated responses. You know, cyber attacks, mm-hmm. Information war, which we're already in. I mean, these kinds of issues require a types of response that I don't think our bureaucracy and our political system itself is really set up to deal with.
Yeah, you know, I actually hadn't thought of the the real sort of mechanics of bureaucracy that you're pointing out, that the deputies get replaced every 4 to 8 years. I mean, how different that we still do have a large cadre of federal workers and civil service employees, but how different is that from, say, you know, Germany?
It's also, if we'll compare it to in Britain, there each government department has something called a permanent undersecretary, and that's the top civil servant in that department, and that person never changes. I mean, are they, you know, sometimes one person gets along better with the new prime minister and one person doesn't, and there's some shifting around, but the departments have ways of training and promoting good people, and you know, there are balances to be had, and sometimes those kinds of systems also don't necessarily produce the best people, but the very idea that a new leader would come in and fire 3,000 or 4,000 people, which is what it is in Washington, and that he would then have to come up from scratch with that number of people to replace them. I mean, we just can't go on doing that, at least not in these sophisticated areas like health policy.
Right. Well, Anne Applebaum and Jack Beatty join us this hour to talk about Anne's fascinating article in The Atlantic called "The Coronavirus Called America's Bluff." There's a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Anne Applebaum. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and a staff writer for The Atlantic. She recently wrote a fascinating piece that appeared in the magazine called "The Coronavirus Called America's Bluff." We're also joined today by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. He's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Megan. I used to do basic research, and I am a pharmacist, and I will tell you that science does not have a political bent. I was recently in a discussion with a Trump supporter on social media, and I pointed out that, well, he was denying that there was a problem. This was all just going to blow over. The president said so. I pointed out that, no, just because we haven't been testing and we don't know how many people we really have this disease, this virus, and that's not good. We have to have a handle on it. I pointed out that Trump dissolved the White House Task Force on Pandemics a couple years ago. And the fellow said, well, of course, it was, and also the CDC had been dissolved or gutted. And he said, well, of course, those were a lot of Obama appointees, and we can't trust them. Mm. And it's like, what? As a scientist or a clinician, we don't have a political bent. We just want to deal with the issue, the problem. But the political climate is such that it's sifted down to the Joe Everyman who believes that there is a political bent. And that is scary.
Right. Well, Anne, thank you so much for that call. Anne Applebaum, there's another aspect of what you wrote that I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to explore. And you say, not only have we undervalued the importance of the kinds of competencies that our caller Anne just talked about, but we also have undervalued the importance of long-term planning. I mean, has the United States post-World War II ever really been that good at long-term planning?
Well, we have been good at some kinds of long-term planning. I mean, if you think about actually, for example, our military presence in Germany or in Europe over many years, very long-term cooperation, construction of alliances, You know, same thing actually in Asia. You know, we had a vision of the kinds of values we wanted to support in the world, and actually we had, you know, military and political cooperation and economic cooperation with a whole set of countries that worked very well over many decades. So we did used to be good at this. I mean, it's not something that's, you know, not part of the American character. But it is true that recent administrations, and this does go back more than just this one, although this one is a kind of extreme version of it, have been less and less interested in long-term planning, more and more interested in keeping up with the news cycle, you know, doing flashy things that will attract attention, and less interested in the boring everyday pieces of diplomacy and regulation that, you know, keep everything going, keeping things ticking over. And that's partly, you know, and that's, I don't want to just blame politicians. It's also true that Americans, in terms of what they're demanding to see and read, aren't asking to read articles about long-term pandemic planning. They're asking for, you know, amusing arguments between, I don't know, the president and the secretary of state, you know, and we have a media that is, and the media has performed beautifully over the last 2 weeks, and I don't want to sound like I'm critical of it, but there is a part of the political culture that is now very much focused on gossip, you know, kind of politics as entertainment, and that's meant that people, you know, attention has been taken off some things that matter, and put on some things that don't.
Mm. Well, you also point out in your piece that, especially, we had a chance after 9/11, because as you said earlier, that where pandemic preparedness was actually on the national radar, but it fell off. So again, that's
it really was. And actually, at that time, a lot of investments were made in long-term research, and, you know, we're going to benefit from some of that now. And, you know, the military actually has been thinking about biowarfare, for example. And so once we can get the military involved in some of that, I think they will also help. It turns out they may have some equipment that will be used. So there were some parts of the U.S. system that were thinking about it, but the hospital system was not, or to the extent that it was, not enough. I mean, we don't have a hospital system that can be cranked up quickly to deal with, you know, hundreds or thousands of extra patients. And we should have had some capacity built into the system that allowed us to do this. But of course, the nature of our healthcare system, which is kind of half private, half state, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Veterans Administration, insurance companies, is not really built for doing this. I mean, fortunately, by the way, you know, to say one optimistic thing, there are a lot of state governments that Right. may turn out to be better prepared than the federal government. And we may see some really great actions it's already happening by governors and mayors. And it may turn out that the federal system in the United States functions better than the national system. Well, and that, you know, locally people are going to be better able to cope.
I actually am glad you pointed that out, because I was just going to say, in fact, state governors took actions before the federal government did. And now only in the recent days are we starting to see closer collaboration between the two, I would say. But Anne, your big picture thesis here about basically what we are being confronted with, and really confronted, is that American government, American bureaucracy, perhaps America itself, is not modern, that we are not the picture of modernity that we believed that we were. I mean, I think, you know, the Hurricane Katrina example is a good one about how there's momentary reminders of that. But we've been living decade upon decade of kind of in a blissful ignorance, right? Because American actions have been largely felt abroad. But this is one case where we can't avoid it, because it's happening here too. Go ahead.
I'm just going to agree with you. I mean, I think that the impact of this should absolutely be to remind people that, okay, we have invented all this fantastic science and we have world's best technology in so many areas. Why isn't the government using it? You know, what's wrong with government? And why is it that all of this, that, you know, that we now have, you know, the most sophisticated communications apparatus in the history of humanity? What is it being used for? It's being used to make a few people rich in Silicon Valley. You know, Why can we not harness some of that capacity for the greater good?
Hmm. Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a very good show. I wanted to point out, I mean, in terms of modernity, just look at American train system compared to what's in Europe or China.
Yeah.
But going back to the main point, I mean, one of the mantra here, certainly in Wisconsin, elsewhere from the Republican Party and the people who vote for them, is that, you know, I know better how to spend my money than the government does, and so we're going to keep cutting taxes so you have more money in your pocket. So I have maybe more money in my pocket, but we don't have enough tests, and the whole country has been turned upside down because of just the lack of testing. I teach, and everything's going online, and it's a real mess. Until we change that mentality, that we actually, unless we pool our money through the government for infrastructure, for medical care, for things like this, we are going to have these kinds of situations, which is why, go off topic with Flint, Michigan, all these other issues, and it's because we have this mentality that the Republican Party keeps pushing and people vote for it.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for that. And I mean, I would agree perhaps in a simpler time that bent of American individualism was right and powerful. But I mean, and part of the issue that you've been talking about is that the complexity of the challenges that we're facing now. I mean, cyber you mentioned, obviously global pandemics, et cetera. Even just the sheer globalized nature of the world. It requires a functioning, nimble, expert bureaucracy, right? That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. That, you know, that's, you know, I still want Americans to be as free as they ever were. You know, I want Americans to be inventive and ingenious like they always have been. I want private enterprise to flourish as it always had, and for people to invent new things and to go it on their own and so on. But there have to be a few areas of public life, you know, in the modern world, in the globalized world, in which we can come up with some collective responses. And by the way, I would make the same argument in Europe. This is not only unique to the United mm-hmm. States. I would say that the European Union also needs to now work together and begin to have some collective responses too. But not, you know, in the world as it's developing now, it just simply isn't enough for, you know, to just rely on individual, ingenuity and grit and so on to fight these kinds of problems. And by the way, you know, fighting pandemics and fighting health crises has, I've just been reading up on it this morning, you know, for centuries, this has been first a city state in Italy and then later a state competence, for centuries now. This is something that many people have recognized in the past as something that's best done as a communal effort. And we're not going to reinvent the wheel here by saying pandemic preparedness and coping with new kinds of viruses is something that needs to be done at a national level.
Yeah. Let's get one more call. Let's go to Randy, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Randy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was struck yesterday by the emphasis Trump put on when they had the live news conference, the emphasis Trump put on the Wartime Production Act and everything. And then I heard later just enough to chill me that he is pronouncing himself a wartime president, apparently until a few trillion germs sign a surrender treaty. And I'm what is that? Considering that he's always playing an angle, what do you think that means going forward?
Randy, thank you for that question. Anne, you have a response for him?
I mean, that's, you know, connected to what I last said. As I said, in the past, pandemics have very often led people to transfer power to the state. And there may be some things, you know, again, in America, this is going to be different because it's going to come from state and regional authorities. So if there's a quarantine in San Francisco, it's coming from the mayor. It's not coming from the president. But it is nevertheless true that when this is over, it will be very important to go back and scrutinize what's been done and take it back apart again. You know, those authoritarian pieces of it that aren't needed in peacetime. But, you know, although that leads me to another really important point is that some of the things that are being done now, and this is not only in the U.S., but elsewhere, are unnecessary. You know, for example, I'm in Poland right now. I'm here because my husband's Polish. It's a long story. I scrambled to get back here last week because the borders were closing and all flights were being stopped and all trains and all buses. And so you had to get onto the last flight or you would have a lot of trouble getting back to the country. That was an unnecessary gesture that was done as a sort of, you know, populist, nationalist, look, we're just going to shut down the borders. And of course, has nothing to do with actually fixing the problem, which is that the virus is spreading inside the country here too. And be on the lookout for grand gestures, you know, like saying I'm a wartime president or enacting unnecessary laws that don't have anything to do with fighting the virus and don't have anything to do with making people healthy, but will give people a false sense of security. Oh, look, here's something big that's being done.
Yeah. So, Anne, I want to circle back to where we began, which is your drawing the analogy of the Meiji Restoration, essentially. I mean, you talked about Japan undergoing in the mid-19th century, beginning in the mid-19th century, a total modernization project, essentially. I mean, what would that look like now in the context that we're talking about American government, American bureaucracy?
I mean, first of all, we mean making Americans aware of how badly their country is doing, which maybe this virus will do that. That was the effect of Commodore Perry's visit, so that we begin to elect different kinds of public officials who can cope with this. That's a part of the answer. Secondly, you know, rethinking the way that we structure the bureaucracy. As I said, do we really need these 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 officials to be political appointees? Can we not have, you know, Dr. Fauci's running important institutions rather than ex-lobbyists who are there for 3 years under one president and will then disappear? Can we not rethink the way our bureaucracy is run, how we choose some of the people who run it? Can we not invest more money in some of these more sophisticated ways of thinking? You know, why aren't we thinking about how to use AI to track pandemics? You know, can we borrow some of the things that the military is doing and bring them into civilian life? Because I said, I think the military may turn out to be ahead in thinking through some of the, because they think in terms of big systems, big dangers, you know, coordinating lots of people. Can we bring some of their expertise to professionalize what should be our new civil service? Can we return some civil service ethos to public bureaucracy? Can we stop talking about the deep state, you know, stop using Trump's language, and talk about civil servants, patriots, you know, people who are working for us? I mean, there's a whole, you know, from bureaucratic restructure through thinking about the kind of language we use, through the kinds of people that we choose to run our country. I mean, all these kinds of things are part of a package. Actually, you know, and I would add to that education. Mm-hmm. You know, are we educating Americans for the 21st century? Are we teaching coding in first grade as a foreign, you know, as if it was a, you know, an extra language, so that kids who like it and are talented at it, you know, can begin much earlier on to do it? Are we teaching people enough math? You know, are we preparing? I don't mean comparing to compete in the world economy. I mean preparing people to, you know, to protect us and survive, you know, and so that we flourish in the 21st century.
Well, Anne Applebaum, Pulitzer Prize winning historian and staff writer for The Atlantic. The article for The Atlantic was titled "The Coronavirus Called America's Bluff." Anne, thank you so much for this truly bracing conversation. It's much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty, we've got about a minute left here, and I just want to know what you think. Do you think America's up to the task of even accomplishing half of the things that Anne just laid out before us?
Well, we're going to see whether we can be protected against ourselves in terms of the isolation and the anomie, that is, this feeling of chaos and normlessness that leads to. Will we cooperate as we need to save this? Will we be able to set aside, in Tocqueville's terms, part of our self-interest so that the whole, for the good of the whole? Upon that question, much, much depends.
Let's show each other that we can. That's what I want to say. Let's show each other that we can. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, it's always a pleasure to have you on, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you, Magda.
And by the way, our coronavirus does continue tomorrow with our Week in the News Roundtable. What do you think about the political response at both the state and federal level so far? What about that relief package from Washington? We'd love to hear from you, so send us a voicemail. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.